Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Good evening, America. Welcome to Self-Defense for a Stronger Nation. Here in my dojo of democracy, my boxing gym of bipartisanship, you will learn the political arts from a master. If they come for you with aggression, strike yourself first, for this will show common ground. If they do not waver or step aside, grab their fists and plunge them to your face, for this will show them you can work together. If they would do harm to the weak and powerless, you must harm the weak and powerless first, so your opponents will see the error of their ways. If they kick you while you're down and take your money, kick yourself more and give them $700 billion. If they do not relent and bully and blackmail, compromise and gouge out your left eye, for there's a chance they may have taken both. See, we are not blue belts or red belts. More of a mob with red highlights. Like the great Ali, you must float like a butterfly and sting like an earthworm.
Well, that little silly verbal cartoon appeared today in a left-wing newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle website, that is, where the radical scum left, American-hating vermin, the Stalinist Maoist vermin now are portraying Obama as a weakling. They now hate Obama because he has come to the center instead of ruling from the far left. I have very good news to report, which is that the Democrats themselves have shelved the so-called Dream Act within the last few hours. The Dream Act, as you well know, is a nightmare for America, but a dream for the illegal alien mafia. And even the Senate Dems realized that backing illegal aliens free tuition would have been suicide. So Harry Reid's pet plan for free tuition for illegal aliens is over. The Democrats have rejected Obama's compromise on tax cuts. Moments ago, the Senate has rejected a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I think that shows great wisdom at a time when China is arming to the teeth, Russia is arming to the teeth, Iran is arming to the teeth, and even our petty little dictator to the south of the border down there in South America is getting weapons, rockets, etc., that can reach the United States of America. It seems very reassuring to think that our defense secretary and our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have come to understand that perhaps national defense is more important than appeasing the radical lobby that wants Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed. So perhaps there is some sense at some point in the governmental thinking. I don't know when this is going to hit the fan, but the big question today is this. Why can't the press decide when espionage is espionage, not journalism? We're talking about the case of the slimy Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. The man, in my opinion, has clearly committed espionage and blackmail, by the way, and we have a government that can't even stop him. I want you to think about this. Please listen to me. And I got to tell you something. Obama's war on the military, Obama's war on national security, and Obama's war on the average person being strip searched at the airport is so phenomenal in light of the fact that his ability to wage war against our real enemies is null and void. If Julian Assange of WikiLeaks can do this to the United States government and not be stopped by FBI, DHS, I don't know, you name every spy agency in the country. Military, supercomputers, NSA, and they can't stop one degenerate from releasing classified information that threatens our national security. Tell me if you feel safer this morning when you consider that China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Iran could do the same thing to us and probably has penetrated every one of our secrets. If Julian Assange can get into State Department records, in other words, why do you assume that the enemies of our way of life have not already done so? Why is this happening to us is the question. How is it happening that we have such an incompetent weakling as president that he can let an unknown cyber bully, cyber hacker, cyber terrorist, cyber whatever, spy, do this to us and not be able to stop him or shut him down? How is this possible? Well, the answer is actually straightforward. We have a naked Marxist as president. We have a man who has Marxist-Leninist roots. We have a man who was put in power by the enemies of America. We have a man who has waged and is waging a war through his czars and his minions directly against our national security, in my opinion. He is waging a constant war against our national security and our military. I have to say it again because you're not hearing me. You absolutely have to understand that my chapter, Obama's War on the Military and on National Security, is perhaps the most important chapter you could read between now and Christmas. It's in Trickle-Up Poverty. Over 135,000, 40,000 of you have bought the book. That's wonderful. I'm not asking you to buy the book to make me rich. I'm asking you to buy the book to make America safer. I'm asking you to understand that Obama is dismantling, disarming, and demoralizing our military. He has been doing so. Don't for one minute think that he is a weakling. He is not. I have told you he has systematically tried, and he may yet achieve, in dismantling our nuclear defense through an unnecessary treaty with Russia. He is disarming the ability of our troops to fight and win wars through a maze of politically correct rules of engagement. And he is demoralizing our valiant young men and women on the front lines. No question the troops are brave. They're not the problem. But as I point this out to you, the troops get nailed to a cross when they do their job too well. I have supported several of the troops who have been court-martialed first by Bush. This all started, by the way, under Bush. It didn't start under Obama. It's all one and the same seamless internationalist, globalist mentality where the U.S. military is fundamentally wanting to, they want to neutralize the U.S. military. They want them to fight these kind of politically correct wars, which nobody could ever win. Nobody has ever won a war fought on that basis. War is hell. War is about killing other people. War is not about negotiation. And yet what you have are politicians at the top of the food chain who are hamstringing our fighting men. And that is why we have wars that go on for 7 or 8 years. We also know that the press is a subversive element in America. We know that Associated Press and all of the other vermin in the media would like to see this country broken. We also understand that the left is ever present in the media government complex. We all know that. This started long before Obama. It started during the Vietnam War. Walter Crankenhaus was probably the number one offender in attacking our military during the Vietnam War. But the fact of the matter is, now we have a guy named Gates in charge of the Defense Department. We have a man named Mullen, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who are fundamentally Stepford wives, going along with the radical left-wing agenda at every step of the way, attacking the military itself when the military men say, no, we don't want Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed. No, we don't want a START treaty with Russia. No, we don't want to destroy 50% of our strategic bombers. No, we don't want to destroy 50% of our submarines. No, we don't want to take down 33% of our nuclear missiles. And yet they go along with it. And so do so many Republicans. So as I say to you, you have men on the front lines who are getting wasted or coming home without body parts or coming home emotionally wrecked for the rest of their lives. And we have men who are running them in this war who fundamentally don't want to win this war. Why is it happening? This complete waste of taxpayer money in the war in Afghanistan was frankly the result of the military being run by incompetent leftists who think they're still attending college seminars and this is just a little game for them. It's all spelled out in Trickle Up Poverty. I'll be right back.
Savage.
He was very sharp. He was very sharp kid. He was very, very short of himself. Quite sophisticated.
All right, here's the schmuck stepfather of the WikiLeaker saying he was a sharp kid. So as we say, the vermin doesn't fall far from the rat's nest. Sharp kid, you hear? That would be like Adolf Hitler's father saying he was a pretty sharp chap. Anywho, let me say this. I could see already by the response to the callers, I threw everything at you, and I could see the callers are not interested in politics. I could see already. You're in the holiday mode already with the shopping and the malls, and no one cares. You don't care about any of this. You don't care about missiles going into Venezuela. You don't care about Russia threatening us. You don't care about China eating us up for lunch, the dragon devouring us. You don't care about the incompetence at any level. So I'm going to tell you some jokes instead. I'm going to start to filibuster my own show with entertainment, which many of you like, by the way. So let me begin with this. I just got an email from a friend, and he says, here's some Jewish humor. And he's not Jewish, but it's a funny joke. It's a shorty. Maybe you'll enjoy it. Moshe was sitting at the bar, staring at his drink, when a large troublemaking biker steps up next to him and grabs his drink, gulps it down in one swig, and menacingly says, "Thanks, Jew boy, what you going to do about it?" Moshe bursts into tears. "Come on, man," the biker says. I didn't think you'd cry. I can't stand to see a man crying. What's your problem?" "This is the worst day of my life," Moshe says. "I'm a complete failure. I was late to a meeting and my boss fired me. When I went to the parking lot, I found my car had been stolen and I don't have any insurance. I left my wallet in the cab I took home. I found my wife in bed with the postman and then my dog bit me. So I came to this bar to work up the courage to put an end to it all. I buy a drink, drop a capsule in, and sit here watching the poison dissolve. Then you show up and drink the whole thing. But enough about me. How's your day going?" that's funny. My friend Tony sent it. He said, "Leo Rostin, the great writer and authority on Jewish humor, listed as one of the characteristics of Jewish humor, revenge over the oppressor by the use of guile or circumstance. This is such a story." I thought it was funny. That's all. Because I'm not going to sit here and talk about Obama and bash. Obama bashing is boring, to be frank with you. Yes, it's interesting that the Democrats in the Senate have shelved the DREAM Act. Yes, it's interesting that Dems are attacking Obama over the tax cut deal, even though they don't mean it. That's for their own base. Yes, it's interesting that the Senate just rejected repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Merry Christmas. Yes, all of this is very interesting that this is here. But I'm going to tell you what I want to do soon. I want to have even more fun on the Savage Nation. Here's what I want to do soon. Television is so bad this week. There's no movies. I haven't seen every movie ever made. In fact, the next movie I'm waiting for hasn't even been written yet because it's going to be my novel written. It's coming out this July. It's going to be the biggest book of the summer, the biggest novel of the summer. Incredible. That's going to be a great movie. So I'm flipping around the channels, and I hit Spike Television, which is, I don't know, I see where it wants to. Spike TV is for kids, like teens or something. And I stumbled on a show called 1,000 Ways to Die. And I found myself laughing my guts out. I swear to you, it was so funny. And there are different bits, you know, about how you can die and this and that. Just play the beginning, the opening, guys, of what the show is about. Play it.
Death is everywhere. Most of us try to avoid it. Others can't get out of its way. Every day we fight a new war against germs, toxins, injury, illness, and catastrophe. There's a lot of ways to wind up dead. The fact that we survive it all is a miracle. Because every day we live, we face 1,000 ways to die.
I started laughing in the bed. The dog started laughing in bed. Because, you know, these people, whoever wrote this, they're very sick in the head. And then what they've done is tapped into everyone's deepest fears. Because we all do evade death every second of our life. One way or the other, we're evading it, avoiding it in a car, the vitamins, the breath spray, the mint, the pill. Everything we're doing, don't do this, don't do. We're sitting in total abject fear of these 1,000 arrows of fear. It's the human condition. It's not that we're cowardly. I mean, frankly, it's rational to think about how not to die. But when they turn it into a comedic show, you know, you wind up laughing at it. So I watched the show 1,000 Ways to Die last night, as I said, and one of them was about a Korean family where it's a traditional Korean family living in Los Angeles, and they have a Korean American daughter, and she is dating a Korean-American young man who the father never met. And the Korean father thinks no one is good enough for his daughter. And so the scene is set where the father and the mother and the daughter are injured. The young man comes to their house, their backyard in L.A., and they're serving dinner outdoors, you know, in a little table. Korean food is exquisitely presented, by the way. If you've ever been in a fine Korean restaurant, which I've had the luxury of doing only twice, it's amazing presentation. Very beautiful, you know, round tray, all sorts of little dishes. Incredible. Way beyond anything that we normally eat. We eat sort of like out of a trough compared to how they eat. It's amazing. So anyway, the food is out there. The father glowers at the young man because, remember, his theory is no young man is good enough for his daughter. So he starts challenging the boy, and he says, "I dare you to eat this," whatever the name is in Korean. And he picks up a live shrimp, which is wiggling. And the father stares down at the boy, and he eats the live shrimp, which is wiggles down his throat. So the boy, okay, he's a modern American kid, but he does it anyway, figures a shrimp. Then the father says, "Okay, now I dare you to eat this makamika mcduko," whatever it is. And it's this disgusting, drippy sea slug. This brown, horrendous liquid comes out of the father's mouth as he bites its head off and swallows it. And the kid says, I can't do that one. So then the father raises the stakes, glowering at the young man, and he says, "Oh, yeah, I'll dare you to do this. You're not strong enough to be with my daughter." And he shows a live octopus on the table, a small one, and he puts it in his mouth, and he bites it and swallows it with the tentacles hanging out of his mouth as he stares at the young man. He starts to gag, bends over, and dies because the live octopus, the tentacles stuck to his the suction cups to his throat, couldn't get air, and he died. That's the thousand ways to die. So the minute we come back, I'm going to ask you a question. No matter what your ethnic group may be, Italian, Jewish, Irish, Polish, Russian, how did your father treat your boyfriends when you first brought him home? Or if you're a brother of a sister, how did your father treat the guys your sister brought home?
Savage.
Kim swallowed the octopus whole and thought he was ready for dessert. But the octopus was a fighter and latched onto the inside of Kim's throat. All those sucking tentacles clogged Kim's throat, and he choked to death. Kim was set in his ways and didn't think anyone was worthy of his daughter. But that kind of thinking, it'll kill you.
Oh, little girl of mine, do you sure look fine?
So there it is. So you swallowed the octopus and died. And I've asked you, if you are a daughter, a woman rather, when you were a dater, and you brought a guy home, how did your father treat them? In other words, I know that there are some old school guys, and particularly in my generation, who were not very nice to the guys when they were brought around to a house. In fact, they were mostly hostile because they knew there was one thing the guy wanted and one thing only. Do I have to spell it out? I mean, you don't even have to laugh at that. It's human nature. Today, of course, it's nothing. Today, the father would probably have a drink with the guy and ask him to share something, a picture of his daughter on the internet, for all I know. The sickos and the drugs in our society. You don't know anymore. But there are traditional families that are very strict and severe with regard to their daughter's honor, particularly our fellow citizens who happen to be of the Muslim faith, who are not fanatic. I can guarantee you they still practice this. I happen to know for a fact that very religious Christians are this way. Religious Jews are this way. They don't even let their children touch a boy's hand until they're married. Did you know that? You don't even know this goes on. You think that it's not true because you see such sluts in the media portrayed as... You see the sluts in the media today are held up as role models in a way that you can't imagine. So you think that they're the norm. They're not the norm. I don't believe they're the norm. I believe that they're the exception. The sluts that the media portrays and throws in your face every day are like Julian Assange is to journalism. That's what they are to femininity today. But you wouldn't know it because the vermin in the media are so whacked out that they would have you believe everyone's a slut and a drug addict and in rehab. Like that's all of a sudden like a pride. She was in and out of rehab. They're supposed to hold that up? In my day, you hid that if you went into rehab. Now they hold it up. It's a thing. I'm rehab. I should care you were in rehab. To me, you're a sicko if you went into rehab. A weakling and a sicko. I wouldn't want to know you. What do I care if you were in rehab? What does that mean to me? So what would your father, how did he deal with, whether it was 20 years ago or even today, how do fathers deal with dates that come around? Now, I really am searching now. I'm culling the audience that's not interested in nuclear weapons. The audience is not interested in Obama's weakness or strength or Marxism. They're only interested now in relaxing and jingle bells and shopping. All right, that's a culture. You fight that, you don't know what's it. Then you wind up doing the worst radio in the world. If you're going to try to fight the tide of humanity right now, which is really not, their minds are not focused. They're already on holiday mode. In a way, everyone needs a break. It's the end of a long year. We had the election. Everyone needs a break except me. So I come in and I do the job I have to do. So I'm going to do this for a little while till we get back to politics, you know, and I will. So let's go to the callers. And I'm looking for the most bizarre. Like, let's say we're going to get a caller that, hi, Mike, my father was a Hopi Indian. And before anyone could date me, he had to dangle from guy wires from an elm tree through his pectoral muscles. Like in the movie, what was that movie with Richard Harris? Remember 20 years ago? Who remembers that movie? That was a great movie. In order to prove his manhood, he had to dangle from he dangled the date from a tree with fish hooks through his pectoral muscles with his hands tied behind his back, and he couldn't even scream, ouch. Then if he lived through that, he would have a peace pipe with him, and he might be able to date me. I'm looking for one of those. Let's start with Johnny in the New York, WOR. Go ahead, Johnny. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Rob, real quick, Mike. My sister was 2 years older than me, and back when we were teenagers, I believe she was probably sophomore year, junior year. It was just before she was driving. She went out on her first date, and I'll never forget, the guy came to pick her up in the car. You know, we were all standing by the window. It was like a big, exciting thing, and the guy blew the horn. Wow. If I tell you.
Wait! The guy blew his horn?
The guy blew his horn, did not come to the door, did not knock, did not introduce himself to my parents.
Oh, it was like honk, honk, and come on out to the car thing.
Oh, my goodness. Blew the horn, my father blew his lid, made my sister go outside and tell him that he had to leave and she couldn't go on the date. Well, I tell you, she cried and cried for days. It was hysterical.
And they're married now 40 years later with transfusion trees in Boca Raton?
No, nothing like that.
I'm joking. They're swinging mutual transfusion trees in an old age home in Boca Raton. They've lived happily ever after. Did she marry him?
No, she didn't marry him. She moved on with her life. I don't think she ever spoke to him again much after that. But
That's an interesting one. All right, let's hear another one. Is there something crazier yet? No? How about reversing it? How about if you were a guy who went to a girl's house from a certain ethnicity whose father treated you harshly? Let's let the guys call now. I never had such problems. I don't know. The girls I dated had either weakling for fathers or the fathers were busy somewhere else. I never had a father say a word to me. They were all very nice. I didn't honk. I went in, but there was no problem with it. I don't understand. But in cultures today, some still do this. There are still cultures that protect their daughter's honor, aren't there? Or am I it's just a movie now. All right, whatever. We'll move on. Oh, no, we got some of that. A lot of callers on this one. Who's the best one? Virginia. Carrie, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Mr. Savage. My parents set up a desk area for my scooter. The first time he came to see me, they put up a glossy picture of me on the desk, and there was a two-page questionnaire there. First question, are you a virgin? Second question...
Wait a minute, stop. The question, are you a virgin, was for the suitor, the boy who came through the door?
Correct, because
Whoa.
They expected me to have that standard, and they felt that I deserved no less.
So what happened? Did guys would fill this out?
Well, this is one particular guy, because this was the first guy that I thought that I would be serious with. So they not only did they have the questionnaire where they kind of almost did it as a joke, but not really, because then they asked him to write a 300-word essay explaining why he deserved the privilege of dating me.
Wow. Now, how did this end up? Where did it go from there? Did you get married? Did anyone ever pass the test?
Well, see, he sort of kind of passed with my stepfather, but my mom, she had the gut feeling, and because I was close to her and we talked openly, we dated for about a year and a half, but I always had this nagging feeling because she said, sweetheart, I can't put my finger on it, but I know he's not the right one for you. If you would just...
Wait, you're telling me he turned out to be Bill Clinton, right?
No, he was a real... really good guy, but he wasn't really good with his money. And he was a little bit, instead of...
So who'd you wind up marrying? Like, how did that happen? I don't mean the man's name or anything. Did you get married?
Yeah, I'm married. I'm happily married. I'm expecting my third baby. I married a naval officer.
Oh, so he did sit down and answer the questions, honestly?
Absolutely.
Well, so you got the right one because your parents were so strict.
They were the best screeners. And, you know, when I was young and headstrong, I didn't understand it. I kicked against the pricks. But I am so thankful to God that they protected me. And, you know, I did marry a virgin. And I was 25 and he was 26 and he had been out to sea. But he had guarded himself because he felt that that was the most important gift he could give his bride. And I am
unbelievable.
So
well, I tell you, this is a heartwarming story. I didn't even know that a story such as this could be told in truth today in this country. I'm serious. You know, I'm a cynical guy and I tend to be sarcastic because it's a defense mechanism. But when I hear a call like this, it's actually reassuring to believe that such purity still exists in this beautiful country, Carrie. I'm going to send you a wonderful Christmas present of trickle-up poverty. Thank you for sharing that with us. That's a beautiful story. I feel like Perry Como. It's so touching. Waco, Texas. Mike, let's hear your story. How did your father treat the suitor?
My first girlfriend's dad was making coleslaw. It's in the neighborhood. I was only 15. I couldn't even drive. But I had to go meet him still. And I go into the house, and this big linebacker ex-Marine with a big head of cabbage and a meat cleaver. And every time he brought that knife down, he said, I love my daughter. Whack.
You mean he would look at you while he was chopping the cabbage?
Absolutely. And we're in the neighborhood. I cut his grass. And, you know, I did odd jobs around his house, but I'm taking his daughter to the movie. And it's like the first time we ever saw her. I love my daughter. Chop, chop, chop.
And how did this end up? You didn't marry her, did you?
No, we didn't, but I think I brought her home early.
Yeah. I wonder if she's still in the house 30 years later waiting for the right guy to show up.
No, I think I heard that she married a restaurateur in Austin, Texas.
Well, maybe he had a bigger cleaver than her father did.
Maybe.
Mike, I'm sending you a Christmas gift, Trickle Up Poverty. I'll be right back. So we're doing a little family stuff, you know, how did the rough father treat the dates, which is very funny, but I'm going to throw in a few, politics here. Here's the big story, okay? It came out a few hours ago, really. Senate fails on repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell included in the defense bill, which is very good because Harry Reid couldn't get the votes required. He couldn't garner the necessary 60 votes for a motion to start the defense authorization bill, which contains a provision to repeal the ban on openly gay people serving in the military. The final vote was 57-40. What this means is that Obama's juggernaut is over, as you can expect. I mean, it took effect, really, not yet. In other words, the vote last month, October, the election day, the old guys are still in office, but even they are now afraid of the voter. So they're not jumping all of a sudden to the tune of the radical Marxists. Even Harry Reid, who won by the nose of a nose, couldn't get the 60. It's 57-40. But listen to this. The snake, Joe Lieberman, comes out and says he's going to introduce a freestanding bill to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The snake, Joe Lieberman, who makes believe he's on both sides of the aisle and he's really nothing but a two-faced phony, is now going to go and stab the leaders of the military in the back and try to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's your Senator Lieberman for you. That's the real Senator Lieberman, that whiny, slimy, he's only fit for Fox News, Lieberman. That's all I could tell you. He's perfect for the people on Fox News. He's on both sides of the fence at the same time. So that's the story. That's a big story. Global warming, dead. People are freezing to death all over Europe. They can't even get a quorum to talk about it in England. Let's see, another big story. They threw eggs or something at the prince, the schmuck with the riding around over there. Thousands attack car containing Charles and Camilla. I'm not into royalty anymore. It's time to end it. It's time for him to get a regular job. He could get a job as a chimney sweep, you know, finally Prince Charles, after all these years. and do something. You look, he's against carbon, isn't he? Prince Charles is a big environmentalist. He likes to do watercolors, never worked a day in his life. He knows how to tie a knot, a Windsor knot, because they invented it in the castle. But I would think that at this stage of history, what is this with the royalty living off when you think about it, think about how the royals live in England. Do you think that's appropriate when people are starving to death? Do you think it's appropriate for them to be living off the fat of the land that was garnered through the worst horrors you could imagine during the colonial era of Britain, the imperial era of Britain? Isn't it time for him to get a regular job? So since Prince Charles, in other words, to cut to the chase, is such an environmentalist and so against carbon dioxide, how better could he show that he's true to his ideals than to abandon the princehood, put on plain coveralls, and become a common chimney sweep, ridding English chimneys of carbon? I think that would be a useful thing for him to do. Chicago, Steve, you're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, I have two teenage daughters, and I have a contract that any potential dater must call and make an appointment to meet with me, read through the contract, and sign it, and then he will ask me for permission if he can take my daughters out.
Oh, this is getting good. You're saying you're currently doing this in the year 2010?
I am currently doing this. Right now, I am 50.
So you're an old school kind of father. Your daughters, are they happy with your behavior or not?
Absolutely. They tell any boy that is interested in them about the contract and about the meeting. And when they come over to the house, they meet in the library where I have my gun case on display. And the very first question is, what are your intentions with dating my daughter?
Wow. So may I ask this, and I don't mean to be, sarcastic. What is your ethnic background, Steve?
I am a white fourth-generation Marine. I was raised to respect women. And the very last question on the contract is, I fully understand that the word no means no.
And then the fifth point says, if you dare touch my daughter below the neckline, you agree to have your hands chopped off, probably.
I'm 6'5", 240 pounds. So they.
So you're the father. Every teenage boy lays in bed at night fearing.
I treat them well, but my oldest daughter has had the same boyfriend for 2.5 years. We have a really good relationship. Never once has he ever been late.
No, it's actually beautiful. She'll probably wind up with a decent husband as a result.
Well, I hope so, and my girls appreciate it because I treat their mother specially, and they see that. And I said,
but Steve, when you were dating your wife, did she have a father who was equally protective?
No, not at all. Not at all. I just how I was brought up.
So, but her father, your father-in-law, wasn't around, or he wasn't active. What?
He was around, but he just was not as disciplined and strict as my dad. And it was kind of surprising to me to see that a father who had a beautiful daughter wouldn't have a little bit tighter reins than he did. So
that's amazing. Yeah, but your wife picked someone who respected her. On her own. She didn't need the father threatening you for you to respect her.
No. Her father didn't have to threaten me. I don't threaten these kids. They just know that I mean business.
Well, but your girth, your size, is intimidating sufficient to keep them in line, which I'll tell you, in this day and age, I can understand. I really do. I don't know how anyone can raise a daughter today without being kind of a hard guy, because you know that the more mores and the morale... the mores of the society today are so degenerate, it's almost impossible to raise a teenager in a proper way, other than through some kind of, let us say, subtle force. Let's put it to you that way, or a subtle kind of threat. But I don't think things have ever been different, Steve. Truthfully, go back 100 years, you think it was any different? I think you still had to have a father who was in the background for the daughter to be treated right, or a brother. There had to be somebody there to take care, to protect that daughter. I think so.
I think so too. And there's nothing wrong with learning manners. My girls know that a man should open the door for them and help them with their coat. And I've done that by example. They've seen that their whole lives. And I
that's amazing. See, now people listening to the show in New York are going to probably laugh at this. You know how they are. They're going to think, oh, how quaint and what right-wing throwback. You know, excuse me, you sneeze on the truth. I just sneeze. But you're actually teaching America that this type of morality still exists in the country. And you're a perfectly normal family. I mean, you're not living in some kind of compound. You're not living in a cult. You're a normal family in Chicago, in the Chicago area. And there are many, many, many men like you who are still raising their daughters in this manner. I don't think America knows this because the popular media is filled with such pollution, you wouldn't think this exists. So, Steve, thanks for listening. I'm sending a free Christmas present out to you, and that's a free copy of Trickle Up Poverty. When I come back in the next hour, we're going to talk more about dating and how fathers-in-law or future fathers-in-law, or even the fathers, rather, how they treated you as a man, or women. This is a talk show for you, too. How did your father treat boys who came around when you were a teenager? And we'll go back to 1,000 Ways to Die. I will continue to update you on the important news. I will read excerpts from my Trickle Up Poverty. And we'll have an otherwise wonderful time for the rest of the afternoon or early evening right here on the Savage Nation. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255 or visit me at michaelsavage.com.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Most of us try to avoid it. Others can't get out of its way.
What the remark? Courtesy Spike TV. Make sure I say that.
Toxins. Injury.
Say credit Spike TV. Catastrophe.
There's a lot of ways to wind up dead. The fact that we survive it all is a miracle.
Papa loves Mambo. Mama loves Mambo. Look at him sway with it, getting so gay.
Well, that's from the Spike television show, 1,000 Ways to Die. I mean, I just got to tell you, I watched it by accident last night. I had a heck of a good time. It was quite a change from watching Hitler and Stalin and the Battle of Stalingrad. I seem to be obsessed with military history shows because it puts things in context. I mean, normally I watch military history, and I'll tell you why I do it. A, it's usually about World War II where the bad guys always lose. You see them strutting in their boss suits in Germany, and in the end, they reduce their nation to rubble as a result of their evil hubris. That's number one. But, you know, I watch the military history for a lot of other reasons. You see the faces of the young men who were fighting in World War II, and they look just like the teenagers of America today. The same faces. There's almost no difference. And I want, you know, I had lunch with a friend today by chance. We wound up in a taqueria. We ran into each other and we had a, you know, simple lunch. And he was saying, oh, I think it's all over. I think America's ruined. I don't think we could ever fight another war and win it. And I said, Bob, listen to me. I said, you know, I watch military history. Look at these kids' faces from 1941, 42, 43, Tarawa, Iwo Jima. Scared to death going ashore in a landing craft. I said, they were no different than the kids today. I said, the Japanese thought that they would wipe the floor up with the American guys. They said they're too weak. They said that they're too degenerate. They said all they want to do is go to dances and eat hot dogs and go to Yankee Stadium. And that the Japanese troops were so much tougher. They lived on one handful of rice, and they were raised in the concept of Bushido, and they would, you know, kill our guys. And, you know, but it goes back to what Patton said. Patton said that when you see your friend's guts hanging out, you'll know what to do. And I think it's still true. I don't care who the person is. You throw these guys into combat, and they see their friends' guts hanging out, they're going to fight for their lives just the way our men have done in the past. I'm not saying that we want to go there, nor am I saying it's desirable to go there. War should be avoided at all costs unless our freedom is at stake. I understand all of that, and I've said that before, but I'm not as, let us say, pessimistic as some are about the American boys not being able to fight. I don't think it's true, number one. There is a compounding variable, and that is the amount of drugs, legal drugs, in the systems of our youth. I think the doctors are criminals. I think the psychiatric profession should be investigated. I think the links between the psychiatrists and the drug company should be investigated. I think the overuse of Prozac and Ritalin and such compounds is at a level of criminality, because it's at epidemic proportions, and I think it should be eliminated. but, you know, that's a topic for another day. So anyway, I took a break from all of that and watched Spike TV last night, as I say, and I stumbled upon A Thousand Ways to Die, which was hilariously funny. I mean, some of the segments were better than others. They're reenacted and made up. It's pretty funny. And so they showed the one with the Korean dad who challenges the suitor to his daughter. No one is good enough for his daughter. No one was good enough for Kim's daughter. And so he challenged the boy to this eating contest. And then I brought up the issue, which we're going to raise again today, which is, how did the father of the daughters you dated treat you? Or if you were a girl, if you are a woman, when you were a teenage girl, what did your father do when suitors came around, I asked. I still think it's a funny topic, in the midst of which I will introduce and inject the news of the day or stories that I think are important for you to talk about, but I can't beat you up with the news right now, because it's, I don't know, people don't want it anymore. I think they're a little burned out, okay? So, I remember I made a reference in the last hour to the movie A Man Called Horse. Remember that movie where a young man in this Indian tribe had to be hung by his chest, shoulder, and back muscles with large wooden splints and ropes hanging from the roof of a hut? And then these ropes were attached to fish hooks, which went through his skin. And then the young boy in this tribe, I think the Mandan is called, Doug? Mandan? The Mandan tribe? And that was a rite of passage, a little different, let's say, than a bar mitzvah. The boy had to fast for 3 days, and then had be hung from his pectoral muscles by ropes which went through hooks into his pectoral muscles. And despite the pain, the boy was not allowed to cry out in pain. And while the Indian boy was hanging in the air, more splints were hammered through his arms and legs. Skulls of his dead grandfather and other ancestors were placed on the ends of the splints. Eventually, the young man fainted from the loss of blood and the sheer pain of this torture. And then, when the elders of the tribe were sure he was unconscious, he was lowered down, the ropes were removed, and yet the splints were left in place. And then when the young man recovered consciousness, he offered his left pinky to the tribal elders to be sacrificed. He placed his finger on a block, and he had it swiftly chopped off. This was a gift to the gods and would enable the young man to become a powerful hunter. You hear? I mean, we're not talking about Yakuza in Japan. Finally, the young man ran inside a ring where his fellow villagers had gathered. And as he ran, the villagers reached out and grabbed the still embedded splints, ripping them out from his skin. The splints weren't allowed to be pulled out the way they had been hammered in, but had to be torn out in the opposite direction, causing the young warrior even greater pain and worse wounds yet. And this concluded the day's ceremony, and the boy was now a man. Okay, now, I was not raised that way, I have to admit it right now. Although I feel that I had an overly harsh upbringing, I must admit I was not hung by my pectoral muscles or by any other portion of my body from the rafters of our house on Utopia Parkway. I myself was raised on mental torture and guilt. which to this day have made me a much tougher man and a much better talk show host. Because the truth is that if you raise a child on this kind of on mental torture, yes, a lesser man would crack from it and perhaps become a lawyer or a journalist. But if you're tough enough and you can survive that, you're basically prepared for anything in life. Because you find out as you go forward in life that life is really hard. Virtually everybody you meet in business is an SOB of the lowest order, and they're going to try and rip you off. Frankly, my father did me a lot of favors by raising me that way. And here I am years later, not a journalist, thank God. But a talk show host, still hanging in there and still doing my job, I think, for God and the country, not for the Queen. So if you'd like to talk about how the fathers of your day, or even today, we had some interesting callers in the last hour. They're still doing it. I mean, one guy said that he went to a house in Texas. The father was a 6'5" Marine who, when the boy would come to the door, and in his case, it was him, the father had a big knife in his hand, and he would be chopping a cabbage, and he would stare at the boy as he chopped the cabbage and say, "And what do you propose doing with my daughter, Chop Chop?" There are other some interesting, cute stories. So you see these things go on even into the modern age. Now, when I brought this up in my head this morning, I really had hoped I'd get some callers that were really kind of really odd. I've gotten good ones so far. I was hoping I'd get a Sicilian caller. Yes, my father did this, or I'd get an Indian caller, like a Native American caller, who would say, a woman now, that my dad did this to the dates. You know, I mean, I really was looking for something interesting. So if you fall into that category of bizarre and interesting and tough in story about dating, whether it was yourself or you're a brother of a sister or you yourself did it or whatever, the phone number is 1-800-449-8255. You're listening to Trickle Up Poverty by Michael Savage. I'll be right back.
Savage. Du hast mich. Du hast mich. Du hast mich.
It is Savage Nation listening to Little Rammstein. Yeah, I wish there was a new version of this. I love this particular music. I don't play it much anymore. It's the other side of my being. But, so anyway, we went from a man called Horse, where they hung him by his pectoral muscles with the fish hooks and the thing. But I was not raised like that. May as well, my song could be called A Man Called Borscht. I never ate borscht. I don't even know what it is. But it's a Russian dish of something like chopped... chopped beets. I never liked beets. I don't even like beets that are not. I never liked beets. It's like a poverty food. There was always stand of beets. I do like certain of the ethnic foods, but not beets. I'm not into a beet. Okay, speaking of which, let's go to Chris in Houston for how he was met at the door by the father-in-law. Chris, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Mike, big fan. Yeah, so I guess I met my wife, I've been with her for around 11 years now.
Right.
First date, I'm a young guy, 19 years old, go to pick her up. Don't know what I'm going to expect when I get in, so I walk in the door. They're having a party, it was near holidays, probably this time of year. And right. I walked in and, you know, Russian background, she's immigrated from Russia, so they have a lot of Russian friends. I walk in and there's three guys, two of them are named Vladimir. You know, they look like they're right out of a Russian mafia movie, and they just start, you know, grilling me one question after the other. What are you doing? Where are you taking her? What time are you going to be back? And you know, she's a princess, and I treated her like one.
Well, I'm sure you did. I'm positive that they didn't need to accompany you with chaperones.
No. She was had her back early, and
oh yeah, right on time. So, did you marry this girl?
Yeah, I married her, and an ongoing joke through the family was, you know, I'd come in. She went to school out of town, and we dated while she was in school. And the ongoing joke for about 3 years is, still same guy. You're not scared away at all.
Mm. Oh, you mean the others probably didn't go? Didn't ever came back?
No, the other guys I don't think lasted very long, but we.
So are these gentlemen still in your life, Vladimir and Vladimir?
Yep, the two Vladimirs, the Alexei, they're all still around.
Oh, well, I don't want to ask any more questions about their particular. Are you part of the business now?
No, but I know people who know people.
Yeah, well, so, but how does that relate? How do you relate to a family that is in that other world and you're not in that world? How does that work?
Well, no, you know, that's kind of an ongoing joke within the family, but we're both immigrants. I'm not from America. My wife isn't either. And, you know, when you actually,
Where are you from? What country?
I'm Canadian, originally.
Well, that's like not from another country. Come on, Canada's like a province of America, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, like Canada's little, or America's little brother, but...
Canada's like America light. I like that description. I just made it up. Well, Chris, I will send you a Christmas present. You know, the Russians have a wonderful Christmas celebration. They're on a different calendar, and they celebrate New Year's Eve on a different time, don't they? Different date, rather.
Yeah, we're about, Russian calendar is about 2 weeks later for both.
Yeah, it's like, what is it, the Gregorian calendar or something?
Yeah.
Because when I lived in New York many years ago, I had Russian friends, and I celebrated New Year's Eve with them. They really know how to party, I got to tell you. With the ducks and the geese and the drinking, beautiful night. But it was like 10 days later than our New Year's Eve, which I thought was very nice to have two New Year's Eves, in essence. That's the benefit of having friends from other countries, is virtually not a week goes by without a celebration on someone's calendar.
Yep. And actually, can I switch topics on you really quick?
Go ahead.
So when you talk about, the title of the book that came out from Obama, you know, The Audacity of Hope.
Yeah.
And I kind of see that in a different light. So if you look at my family, from my side of the family, my dad, you know, nobody has ever gone to college. He came over here, made a good life for us. I've graduated. My youngest brother's in college, and my middle sister is going to med school right now. And
wait, is this all because of the tough upbringing? Is that what you're saying?
The tough, you know, the dedication, understanding what hard work is and looking
well, at... Well, I was raised not so tough, but with that, as I say, honest to God, it was like, it was told me point blank, you either make it in this country or you're nothing. In other words, you're man-child in the promised land. We didn't have a chance. You do. You make something of yourself or you're going to be a failure. We'll look at you as a failure. That's how I was raised. I've even said it on the show. I used to read stories when I was in college of Japanese students who would come over here, and if they didn't get straight A's and go to the top of their field, they would commit suicide, some of them, because they were ashamed that they failed their families. I actually related to it, to be honest with you. I mean, I never wanted to commit suicide because I got a D, which I did. I got a D in genetics, incidentally. It's another story for another day. All right, TUP goes out to you, 1-800-449-8255. We got a short shot here. Let's start with Marsha in New York. Marsha, you say that you're thankful your father was tough. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, first of all, I'm very grateful because he taught me a tremendous level of self-esteem. But my father was 6'9 and a half, 250 pounds. So when he entered... Sure.
6'9". It ought to be 6'9 and a half, not 6'9", but 9 and a half, with a voice that you know already came out of La Cage aux Folles, and so therefore we don't buy it at all. But I mean, come on, it could be funny up to a point. Nobody's 6'9 and a half. They might be 6'9 and a quarter, yes, but not 6'9", not 6'9 and a half. When I return, the news of the day, along with the incredible stories of women and their tough fathers, right here on the one and only Savage Nation.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. May I direct you to the website, michaelsavage.com. Why is Savage not in WikiLeaks cables? And today the Washington Times picked up the story asking, why is there no record of Michael Savage being banned in the WikiLeaks cables? The answer is because Julian Assange, who is now being held up as a hero by the vermin left, has released only those cables which advance the left-wing agenda. In other words, anyone who is a conservative that may be made to look better is certainly not going to be the subject of any of the WikiLeaks cables. I mean, use your head. If then Home Secretary Jackie Smith in England has a correspondence going back and forth with members of the UK government, including Gordon Brown, then Prime Minister, and I have some of these emails in my book, Banned in Britain, and none of these are released by WikiLeaks. Why? Because they don't want you to see that I was victimized, A, by the British government, and B, there might be complicity from someone or some elements within the U.S. government, which is no doubt true. So there you go. So the WikiLeaks story is only half the story. I believe the governments of Britain and possibly the U.S. were involved in plotting this evil, Mr. Savage declares. Do you think the WikiLeaks people are not posting these cables because they would show that I am the victim of an evil government? So there it is. You know, everything is half the story. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Now, I want to read again from some of the ways the rites of passage of young men. We told you one with the hanging from the hooks, with the fish hooks and the breast for days. And then crazy, huh? And remember the movie A Man Called Horse? Well, deep in the heart of the Brazilian Amazon lives the Satir Maui tribe. How do they become a man? A boy must stick his hand in a glove woven with bullet ants and withstand the bullet ant stings for over 10 minutes without making a sound. The bullet ant has the most painful sting in the ant world, described as waves of throbbing, all-consuming pain that continues for 24 hours. To make the glove, the tribesmen will knock out the bullet ants with a natural sedative, and while the ants are docile, the elders proceed to make their torture device by weaving the ants into a glove made of leaves with the ants' stingers facing inwards. When the ants regain consciousness, the boys put on the gloves and face 10 minutes of hell. The copious amounts of venom the boy receives during the ordeal temporarily paralyzes his arm and leaves him shaking uncontrollably for days. This is not a one-time deal either. A young boy in this tribe may have to stick his hand in the bullet ant glove several more times before he's considered a man. And each time he experiences this ordeal, the object is to remain as quiet as possible. It's a test of manly endurance and stoicism that's necessary to be effective warriors for the tribe. Now, you may say, is there a survival value in this? Of course there is. These people didn't go to Safeway to buy a piece of meat in plastic. They lived in a jungle. The boys had to go hunt monkeys. They had to hunt jaguars. They had to hunt dangerous animals. And often in the hunt, they might get stung. They might get bitten. They couldn't send a letter home and sue the jungle. They couldn't scream. They couldn't blow a whistle and say that they were going to sue somebody for letting the ant out of the hive, out of the whatever they live in. Now, I wasn't exactly raised with bullet ant clubs, but I had to clean bronzes with cyanide for my dad deep in the basement of Ludlow Street. And I didn't know whether the cyanide was the lethal or the non-lethal salt. As Charles, the producer, just reminded me. He remembered the story from my earlier incarnations here on the Savage Nation. That's right, Addis. Go down in that horrible basement in the antique store. I didn't mind cleaning the bronzes. I mean, a kid don't know. I knew it was poison. My father used to order these huge barrels of cyanide, balls of cyanide, hard balls of cyanide salt. And he dropped them in water, and they become a cyanide solution. And I would dip my toothbrush in it, and I wouldn't brush my teeth. I'd brush it on the bronze statues that had a patina on them that was gorgeous. And for the nouveau riche who would buy the bronze statues, they wanted them shiny. So what took 100 years to build up and make the bronze look beautiful, these nouveaus would want the shiny bronze to look like brass instead of like beautiful patinated bronze. So I'd be rubbing and scrubbing in the mirror. But that was okay. A kid don't know from nothing. He does what he has to do to make a buck. And the father wanted me to do it, so I did it. I didn't see anything wrong with it. Of course, there was something wrong with it, because the only other person my father had to do it was a Bowery bum named Louie, who did it, because he had to do it. He was a bum. But I guess my dad believed in child labor, and he also thought I was too soft for staying at home and eating steaks. This was punishment from the... He'd come home white in the face from a day in the market. Maybe it was a bad day. Maybe no one bought anything, you know, or there was no maybe if there was no income, there was no welfare check. We weren't looking for welfare. They'd rather die and throw themselves off a roof than take a dime, my people. So he had a little store, but let's say the business had been bad. And he'd come home after a snowstorm looking white. And there I'd be sitting, age 11, fattened by mom, eating a steak and French fries, polishing it off with a cherry vanilla ice cream while watching the news with Walter Cronkite. And my father would say, what is this kid going to become to himself sitting there being fed like this, like King Farouk? So as a result, I wound up cleaning bronzes for him in the basement. You know what? I didn't really care one way or the other. The part I cared about was when he would say to me, don't worry, this is the good cyanide, not the stuff that they pellets they drop in a bucket at San Quentin with the guy inhales and he dies. So I would think to myself, Dad, I would think, wait a minute, what do you mean, sodium cyanide solution or potassium? I don't know which one is the good one, he would say to me. I don't think he knew, but he would buy the one that was not the one that they used at San Quentin is all I was told. So I would think, well, what if the guy sold him the wrong one? What if the barrel of pellets that he bought was mislabeled? And the one I'm dropping in water that day was, should have been shipped to San Quentin to kill a murderer. All right, so this went on. As you can well understand, it served me very well in life. I would think in the jungle in which I live, not knowing whether it was the good or the bad cyanide was really perfect for the kind of world that I have now found myself living in. Oh, yeah, life is good. Life could be a dream. Hey, do you have that song, Life Could Be a Dream? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We could play that one. I'm going to take your calls in a minute as I catch my breath. The ant glove we talked about, the fish hooks in the pectoral muscles, that's a nice one. Here's a tribe in Africa with the Hamar tribe of Ethiopia. You have to jump over a herd of cattle. As the relatives chant, in order for the ceremony to be valid, the bulls must be castrated. The initiate is brought to the cattle naked except for a few cords he wears around his chest. The boy must jump onto the first bull and then run back and forth across the backs of the cattle three times. When he's done, a shout is given and the boy is a maza or a man. No, mazel tov. That's where the word mazel tov comes from. Maza tov, I guess. And it was translated by the time he got to Brooklyn into something else. 1-800-449-8255. Dawn in Pennsylvania, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, I was just letting you know what my father used to do when I was a teenager. He would bring out, he had this castration kit for bulls, and he would set that on the table whenever I had male friends coming over, whether they were interested in dating me or not.
And what did the castration kit consist of?
Well, it would have basically a scalpel, and it had in large letters on the front of it, castration kit. And then he would also have a firearm out, usually on the table or somewhere visible in the kitchen, just for the appearance of threat.
So your father was a real tough old-timer, huh?
Yeah, I guess so. He's a native New Yorker, actually.
Oh, native New Yorker who liked castration kits and guns. And what calling was he in that he had to move out of New York?
He was a truck driver.
Uh-huh. And is the gentleman still with us?
Yes.
And how old is the old dude today?
He's 60.
60, and does he still carry the castration kit around in his truck?
Yes, actually he does.
Okay, now you're pulling my leg, aren't you?
No, it's in the kitchen, right in the top drawer by the silverware.
But wait a minute, so let's slow down. Why would he still have a castration kit? Does he raise cattle?
No, it was purely for the threat factor of young
no,
men.
No, I understand, but I'm saying, but why would he still have it since you're now a grown woman? Why would he still have to have a castration kit in the silverware drawer?
Memories, maybe. I don't know.
Ah, nice, fond memories of the early days. I see.
Yeah.
You sure he doesn't take it around with him in the truck to go to do some? It just sits in the kitchen in the drawer, huh?
Yeah,
and would you recommend raising your daughters the same way with your husband having a castration kit on the table?
Probably, yeah. It seemed to do the job without many words having to be said.
Oh, come on, you're pulling my leg, Dawn. You don't mean that. You wouldn't do that to your daughters, would you?
Oh, yes, I would. With the boys.
Oh, and how do your daughters feel about you having a castration kit on the table when a boy comes to take them out on a date?
I don't have any daughters. I have a son.
Okay, so let's turn it around. How would you feel if your son went to a girl's house and her father had a castration kit on the table?
I would hope that there's someone out there like that still.
Oh! Well, I guess I should get your son on the phone and ask him how he feels about a castration kit on every table in your neighborhood. Well, what corner of Pennsylvania do you call home?
Erie, right up by the lake.
Erie, yeah, I know why it's called Erie, Pennsylvania. I understand it finally for the first time in all of my years. Thank you for the call. We now know why it's called Erie, Pennsylvania. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Hey, la di ding dong, la lang a lang a lang, boom ba lo, ba do ba do ba ba.
Oh, life could be a dream.
You know, in my home, I mean, I never heard of a castration kit to control a potential date for a child. I never heard of such a thing. Although, when I think about it, it's a cultural thing, castration kit. I mean, it could be figurative, it could be literal. In my home, we had a castration kit. It was called sarcasm, cymbal shot. So there's different strokes for different folks, I suppose. Stubborn Obama to the Democrats, tax bill will pass despite your revolt. So now Obama's become a Republican. The White House on Thursday predicted a quick passage of President Obama's year-end tax cut agreement with the Repubs, even as left-wing House demon cats revolted against the deal outside. The deal will get passed, says the human gefilte fish Robert Gibbs. Think of Robert Gibbs, the presidential press secretary. The next time you're shopping in a supermarket and you go past the ethnic foods, I ask all of you to please stop outside the kosher food or the Jewish food area and look at the Manischewitz gefilte fish. Imagine Robert Gibbs inside the jar with a pair of carrot eyes, and that you'll know what we have as a press secretary. A press secretary. The human gefilte fish. House Democrats reject tax plan. Then, of course, the news of Prince Charles, oh my, on the way to the theater in his Rolls Royce, being attacked by unruly anarchist students who don't want to pay the tuition. They're raising it to $17,000 a year. You hear in England, it's too much for them. They won't have enough money left over for ecstasy and trips to the Maldives to sleep with crocodiles. But, you know, that was a security breach of a very bad. If the students, see what's, look at the West, they can't control Julian Assange. The whole defense establishment, CIA, FBI, NSA, DSN, Big Sis, they can strip search you and your grandmother, but they can't stop a whack job from releasing state secrets. No matter what he does, they can't stop him. You hear? And we're supposed to believe that they can engage in cyber warfare. And we're supposed to believe that the geniuses running our intelligence apparatus could prevent a blast against our electronic grid. You hear this? Do you have any idea that we're living here like sitting ducks now because of the schmucks who are running everything? Listen, if I were in charge, this wouldn't be going on. I can guarantee you. I would have gotten Julian Assange within 24 hours. If I had to turn England upside down, I would have found him. And I wouldn't be giving him too much of a trial. He had a fast trial. A real fast trial. But that's a different age. The world isn't the world. The world I see isn't the world that exists anymore. That's why when I have a show like this, I get so many callers. I got to tell you something. Today, most talk shows, they don't know what to do. They're out of gas. The same thing every day, the same Obama, this bash the liberals, that. There's only so much you can hear of that. We all have done it. I made a living doing it. All right, so you bought trickle-up poverty, and you'll continue to buy it. How many times can you say the same thing? If there's a news story related to it, okay. So now, the genius of Michael Savage clicks in, and I come up with ideas like this because I'm interested in them. The primary way to survive as a talk show host is to have many interests and be able to project them to the audience. If you don't really have any interests outside of reading four websites and repeating the headlines over and over again, why would anyone listen to you? They read the same websites as you do. They've seen it. You know what I'm saying? Lucky for you, I have diverse interests and a great background, and I'm a father and a scholar and an otherwise all-around wonderful personality, and that's why the show survives. And I am interested in this other topic. I'm not going to do it again. Let someone else steal it tomorrow. Tomorrow I'll come up with something else, probably about something that happened with the dog or dinner tonight or whatever. Incidentally, a side note, complete side note. As you know, I'm writing a novel, and it's a very big challenge. and it's going to be the biggest book of the summer for St. Martin's Press. It's their big, big novel. And I'm not going to tell you anything about it. You can go in their own catalog and see what it's about. But I wrote Teddy into the book. That's right. Teddy's going to finally be a movie star, because when this book is optioned for the industry, the film industry, I'm not going to assign the rights to any movie company unless they agree to hire Teddy as the character Eddie. No, I've renamed him Eddie. That's the only character in the whole book that resembles anyone real is Teddy, because I called him Eddie. Everyone else is either resembles no one living or dead, except Teddy, who can't sue, thank God, because the whack jobs who run the Obama administration have not yet given him human rights. Can you imagine if the lunatics in the Obama administration gave animals human rights, which is what they're trying to, like, give a monkey a human right? My dog could sue me for invasion of fur rights or something. I don't know what he would figure out. But I'm going to be his agent. I'm going to get him a good shot in the movie. I guarantee you one thing. I'm not going to let them kill the dog, even figuratively or literally. He will not be killed either way. You know, I was thinking about that. I saw a movie the other day. I forget the name of it, whatever it was. But, oh, it was that Jeff Bridges movie, Crazy Heart, remember? And I was watching it. And remember when the kid is, like, snatched in the bowling alley or in the mall? I'll tell you what happened. I watched it. And I said, if this kid winds up missing or hurt, I'm turning this movie off. Because I'd never want to watch a movie where a kid gets hurt. Never. I won't even indulge a moment in that. I don't want it. I want the kid to be... if a kid's like, let us... I can live with a kid or a dog being snatched. But I don't want to see them hurt. And if they are hurt, I want them to be found. That's number one. As a moviegoer now. And then I want the guy who did it to be caught and beaten to death with fists. I want him to be beaten to death slowly by fists by the father. That's how I want. I want Charles Bronson to come back, in other words. I'm sick and tired of this. Everything is equivocal. Everything is the other side. Everything is two sides. Everything's upside down in my world. In your world, not in my world. I want the bad guys killed. That's why I can't even watch military history anymore, because I want the enemy dead. I want them dead. I'm sick of this. I am sick of this gray zone war. I want us to unleash our military on the enemy. I'm sick and tired of hearing from these liars at the top of the food chain that we don't know who the enemy is. We know who the enemy is because they tell us every day. We don't know who the enemy is. Every day one of them gets up and says who they are and who the enemy is. They know we're the enemy, but we don't know who they are. Are you kidding me? We don't know who the enemy is, but every day they tell us that they're our enemy, but we don't know where they live and who they are. No, my friends, the enemy within is the enemy. The enemy within is the reason that we're in this state of limbo. And I'm not talking about a talk show host. We're in a state of limbo because we have liars in the highest places. We need men like the ones who called the show today, like that Marine who takes care of his daughters. That's what we need in the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff instead of a PR man who looks good in epaulettes. Captain Kangaroo may as well be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for what we got today. Every day, a mealy-mouthed statement. A pirate hijacks a ship, and we hear we're going to negotiate with him. I take his village off the map. They know where they live. Because these Somali pirates take the money back, and they buy themselves SUVs, and they ride around in the village. Oh, that's what they do with the money after they hijack a ship? My friends, there is a way to fight this war. But we have enemies within. At every level, we have diplomats, and we have... What is a diplomat? Someone is doing a deal on the side to screw you. That's what a diplomat is. Diplomat. It means he's got his hand in the pockets of the guys who you're fighting in order to make sure that he doesn't do anything against them. Anyway, it's one man's opinion. Thank God I'm not a politician. And thank God that I'm not the president. That's all I can say. Because this would be a different world. This is the Savage Nation. The website is michaelsavage.com. The Christmas present that you need is called Trickle Up Poverty. And I shall be back for another large hour throughout most of these United States.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show,
the Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Now, let's see what's on the web. I mean, there's so much news. I don't know if I really want to talk about it truthfully. We know that the House Democrats have attacked the president because he's compromised with the Republicans. We also know that today there's very good news that the Democrat, well, I should say the radical left wing, La Raza wing of the Democrats have stopped pushing the Dream Act because it's not a dream for anyone but the illegal aliens. The Senate has rejected a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They finally got their brains in order. We're fighting two wars. We're facing enemies around the world, and all they're concerned about is gays in the military. Most Americans say they're worse off under Obama. Home values may drop by $1.7 trillion this year. Let us see what else. What is a big piece of news? Student protesters are rioting in London, turning violent over not the Muslim threat. Not the meltdown of Britain. No, they're rioting over tuition hikes. Tuition hikes. They need more money for drugs, sex, and rock and roll. And of course, Prince Charles, the genius, his car was hit with paint and the rear window smashed. Oh, shocking there. Vandals hacked down 2,000-year-old holy thorn tree of Glastonbury. Maybe they could put up some tree from the Arabian desert if it will grow in England. HIV-positive L.A. porn actor calls for condom use. Oh, goodness, please. Give me a break. What else is in the news? Muhammad Ali drops by the George Bush book signing. A pair made in heaven. They both speak about the same rate. At about the same rate. They have about the same... Now, here's the big story today. Which is... The clueless press can't decide if espionage is journalism. This is about the WikiLeaks story. And I'm reading from an article written by Dan Gaynor on Fox News. And he says, imagine that the year is 1942 and the German government runs a news bureau in Washington, D.C., collecting U.S. government secrets. Even FDR would have laughed at claims that they were actual journalists. He would have locked them up and thrown away the key, and he would have been right. There's a huge difference between an individual or an organization reporting abuses in government or business one at a time and the same people stealing enough classified material to run a spy agency. But sleazy Julian Assange and his spy agency, WikiLeaks, are trying to pretend they are journalists. He even calls himself editor-in-chief, sort of like Mata Hari calling herself H.L. Mencken, or Julian and Ethel Rosenberg, the atomic spies of the 50s claiming to be Woodward and Bernstein. This jerk from WikiLeaks even argued in a recent column that WikiLeaks coined a new type of journalism called scientific journalism. As a sign just how far that profession has fallen, many in the media are agreeing with this psychopath. Well, the fact of the matter is we know there is very little, if any, journalism left. And the main headline is, the clueless press can't decide if espionage is journalism. Now, some old-school journalists have come out against WikiLeaks. Former Washington Post managing editor Stephen Cole, now president of the New America Foundation, said of WikiLeaks, so far it lacks an ethical culture that is consonant with the ideals of free media, whatever that means, mild criticism. But The Atlantic criticized him for saying that. He claims that Julian Assange and the spy Private First Class Bradley Manning have done a huge public service by leaking these state secrets. The Spectator UK headline one piece, yes, Julian Assange is a journalist. Another example of Assange's new support from the vermin in the media comes from petitions one after the other. Now, this isn't the first time there's been confusion over whether journalists act as spies. It was a huge concern during the Civil War when generals feared reporters would leak troop movements. Those concerns continued for decades and got even worse as the midstream media took an active role in undermining the Vietnam War. But WikiLeaks is nothing like that. It is an organization based on theft of classified documents that then reveals communications that could cost lives, crush American diplomatic efforts, or cause wars. Then, when this jerk from WikiLeaks gets in trouble, he threatens to release more data. His so-called insurance file is even more dangerous. More encrypted emails. Now this completes the circle by adding blackmail to his list of daily activities. Now the Associated Press is reporting that WikiLeaks has put out a secret cable that lists sites worldwide that the U.S. considers crucial to its national security. American officials said that this leak amounts to giving a hit list to terrorists. And speaking of terrorists, supporters of the WikiLeaks jerk have attacked websites of perceived enemies of founder Julian Assange, including MasterCard. This is unbelievable. This proves WikiLeaks is not a news organization. It is a criminal syndicate that aids the enemies of the United States. It should be shut down and its operatives and helpers jailed at bare minimum and tried for treason. But I have a bigger question. If one schmuck called Julian Assange can do this to the entire West, can you imagine what Russia or China or Saudi Arabia could do to this country? Here we have a military, a CIA, a Homeland Security, and an FBI that cannot stop this man. Do you actually think that they can protect you on a national security basis? Do you feel safer today knowing that one jerk with a few computers can leak all this classified data and this military apparatus of ours can do nothing but strip search your grandmother and make them cry at airports? No, my friends, it tells us an awful lot. We're in very, very, very deep trouble, believe me, when one slimy anti-American leftist can attack this country and the U.S. military spends its time arguing over not espionage, not the threats of nuclear weapons, but over don't ask, don't tell. Now, I point all of this out in Trickle Up Poverty. I have to tell you, it's the best document yet on Obama's war on the military and on national security. It is very important you comprehend that I predicted, not exactly that this would happen, but that with a government so obsessed with politically unimportant but politically correct issues, it's inevitable that our enemies are winning and getting the best of us. What more evidence do you need than what you've seen here with this WikiLeaks case, where it's clear that espionage, not journalism, has been committed? That's it from the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Listen to this audio on the Savage Nation. Remember the Ground Zero Mosque that somehow disappeared just after the midterm elections? Well, the so-called imam, Rauf, has not forgotten. And he said that the dream of a Ground Zero victory mosque, in my words, is still alive.
At the moment, the dream is still alive to establish this center, because the issue is not really about the real estate. The issue is about the broader problems between and the perception between Muslims and members of other faith communities.
Well, he has not forgotten, and now neither have the listeners of the Savage Nation. We don't want the Ground Zero Victory Mosque. Meanwhile, the president has been battling his own party on his latest compromise over taxes. The Dems want higher taxes for everyone, and of course, they are now attacking even Obama.
I think it is inaccurate to characterize Democrats writ large as feeling, quote-unquote, betrayed. I think Democrats are looking at this bill, and you've already had a whole bunch of them who've said, this makes sense. And I think the more they look at it, the more of them are going to say, this makes sense. As I indicated, you've just had economists over the last 24, 48 hours examine this and say, this is going to boost the economy, it is going to grow the economy, it is going to increase the likelihood that we can drive down the unemployment rate.
Now, Obama says that the Republicans will have to explain themselves for their part of the compromise. Good luck.
Republicans are going to have to explain to the American people over the next 2 years how making those tax cuts for the high end permanent squares with their stated desire to start reducing deficits and debt. I don't think that formula works, but they'll have the opportunity to make the case. I'll have the opportunity to make the case that we've got to have tax reform, that we've got to simplify the system, that we do have to cut spending where it makes sense, but we're also going to have to make sure that we've got a tax code that is fair and that looks after the interests of middle-class Americans and continues to grow the economy.
I don't think Obama's laying a trap. I think he's trapped. Now listen to this. Here's the stepfather of the WikiLeaks slime bag who says that he was a sharp kid.
He was very sharp. He was very sharp kid. He was very, very short of himself, quite sophisticated in his way, not just as far as his sense of humor is concerned, but his, the way he looked at the world. He always stood up for the underdog. I remember that, like with his school friends. He was always very angry about people ganging up on other people. Strangely enough, I always thought that he would do something like this. He was always very independent, and he certainly wouldn't take no for an answer. I'd like him to know that I wholeheartedly support him in everything that he's doing.
Well, here's a guy who, in my opinion, has committed espionage, and his stepfather said that he's committed, that he was a very sharp kid. I wonder if the apple has fallen far from the tree. Look, I know you worry about what's going on in Afghanistan from what's going on in the White House, but with all of that, you shouldn't have to worry about your computer on top of everything else. So go visit my advertisers at carbonite.com. They'll back up all your important files so they're safe no matter what happens. Use my offer code SAVAGE, and you're going to get 2 months free with your subscription. That's carbonite.com, offer code SAVAGE. I'm shy of bookstores. I don't go into bookstores for a number of reasons. I haven't for many years, which is a shame. I used to, you know, I mean, a writer should live in bookstores, right? I used to love bookstores, but all right, so I stopped going. But now that I have a raging bestseller, Trickle Up Poverty, I went into my local Barnes & Noble. I was dressed somewhat like a homeless person, which is my normal garb during the week. I bicycle, you see, and when I bicycle, I like to wear old clothing. I don't wear any kind of jester costumes. I leave that to the fools who wear jester costumes on bicycles and show you their butt as they cut you off and wave a hammer at you to break your mirror. So I wear old clothes, I mean, because they're comfortable if you fall. You know what I mean? There's a little water on the ground. I swear to God, so I have one jacket that's 20 years old that I wear. I like it. It's padded if I fall, you know, the whole. So I go in with the helmet, the glasses, the sweatshirt under the helmet. I look like, you know, the Unabomber. And with sunglasses, and no one, of course, knows me, thank God, because I'm not a TV guy. And I go to the bestseller rack, and there's my book, and it was a pleasure. Over comes the manager. Under the garb, she apparently recognized me, and she says, Michael, it's so nice to see you here. I was shocked that she knew me at all. I mean, I'm a local author, but I never make it. I'm not one of these guys who reads his books, and, you know, the postmenopausal crowd and all that, so... She was an African-American lady, the nicest woman you could ever believe running a major league bookstore. And I wouldn't say she was a fan of the show. I didn't even ask her that. She was just a woman knowledgeable about the book business. She said, let me tell you a story. A woman came in last week into this store, and she got in my face, and she yelled at me. And she said, you put that book in that slot where it belonged. And she said it was funny because your listeners are fanatic about this. They won't stop demanding, you know, the right placement in this and that. I thought that was pretty amazing. So anyway, big deal. So I took a picture with a cell phone camera. I had to take a picture finally in front of a book thing. I felt comfortable enough to go to the magazine stand. I don't know how bookstores make money, by the way, because it's filled with deadbeats who sit there all day long reading magazines for free, and then they put them back in the rack all wrinkled up. I feel bad about it. Like, I grew up in a time, I'm even afraid to touch a magazine because it was considered cheating. When I was a kid, if you went into a candy store and you looked at a comic, the guy behind the counter would practically tear your hands off if you read it for free. You remember those days? Who would have the nerve to go into a candy store and look at, let's say, a comic book for nothing? How would you expect a guy to make a living? So it was understood. It was like a social contract. If you went into a store to look at a comic book as a kid, I was trained, my father would say, you buy it. Don't read it for free. That's cheating. So I paid the nickel or the dime. Now you got people in there, mainly liberals with gray beards. They got nothing to do. They're unemployed or probably retired professors, who knows. And they sit around looking scruffier than I, reading the magazines. So today I went in and I read the magazines. I did buy a few. You know, it's funny. You can tell a man by the magazines he reads. Let me tell you what I bought. I bought Flying Magazine. I bought several boating magazines. I bought Hemmings Motor News. I bought some classic car magazine. Something, you know, like cars and stuff like that. Magazines are a lot of pleasure. They're very relaxing. In addition to being interesting, they're very relaxing. Why Flying Magazine? I don't fly. I've always wanted to be a pilot. I can't fly. I don't have the skill for it. I can boat. I mean, I drive a 40-ton boat without any water, but I can't fly a plane. I'm thinking of taking up flying lessons now at my age. Who knows? Why not? I mean, a lot of people do it. I mean, when you think about it, I'd rather die in a plane crash than die of cancer or a heart attack. Symbol shot. Have you thought about that? I mean, do you really want to sit and wait to go to the assisted living with the teeth falling out and have an illegal immigrant beat you up for your small change when your family leaves you there in the last years of your life as they push you into a corner facing an old curtain and you can't move? It's a horrible way to die. They beat you about the head and neck and, you know, take your money. It's worse than a TSA agent. What happens to the old people in assisted living is worse than what happens in an airport screening today. Have you noticed my show has gotten better over the last few months? Do you know why? Because I'm flapping less and I'm coasting more. I've watched old guys sometimes, how efficiently they move or how efficiently they... Well, you know, it's very hard to describe. You ever watch an old boxer? I don't mean old boxer. There are no old boxers. In sports, I don't know if that analogy holds up because the guys break down very young. But there are professions where an individual will do things more with less energy, let's put it to you that way, and do it perfectly. Flap less, coast more. A painter, for example. I've told the story before. I don't want to beat this up.
Savage.
Now, remember, when it comes to national security, nobody has spelled it out more clearly for you than I do in Trickle Up Poverty. The chapter on national security and the war on the military in Trickle Up Poverty is worth the price of the book. I have told you this for months. The administration under Obama doesn't have their head in the sand when it comes to national security. I think they're playing for the other team. Joining us now with an exclusive Savage Nation report is Eric Stackelbeck.
Michael, always a pleasure to be here. And, you know, it seems like every week, literally, Michael, that you and I talk, there is some new case of homegrown jihad here in the United States. Now, last week we spoke about this young Somali-American, a 19-year-old Somali immigrant to the U.S. that the State Department brought here, plotting to blow up a Christmas tree lighting ceremony on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, in Portland, Oregon, of all places. Now, he potentially would have killed thousands of people at this ceremony. Thankfully, he was thwarted.
Well, what is happening now?
This week, Michael, another foiled Islamic terrorist attack here on American soil. I'm sitting in Washington, D.C., just about 30 minutes from here north, outside of Baltimore, a guy by the name of Muhammad Hussein. Now, this is a 21-year-old, once again, young, fits the profile, and fits the other aspect of the profile, Muslim, even though the mainstream media is taking great pains, at first at least, to not identify his religion. So he is a 21-year-old Muslim convert of Nicaraguan descent, which is pretty interesting, but he is a convert. And basically, Michael, this guy plotted to blow up a military recruiting center outside of Baltimore, Maryland.
No.
He spoke now, once again, a great intelligence effort by the FBI, by law enforcement, just like that case with the Somali out in Portland, Oregon. This was basically a sting operation type deal. There was an informant working for the FBI on the inside with Muhammad Hussein, going back and forth with him. And, you know, the liberals and the Islamists want to scream entrapment in these cases.
Well, of course.
But the FBI clearly gave this guy every chance to back out, even warning him, look, you could kill women and children. You could kill a lot of people, have a lot of blood on your hands. The reaction of this young jihadist was, good, that's exactly what I want. So he had every opportunity to back out of this plot. He chose to forge ahead, Michael, and his plan basically was to kill U.S. troops at this recruiting center, and it's no surprise. Time and time again with these homegrown jihad cases, Michael, and I've done a lot of them over the last 10 years, with these homegrown jihad cases, 9 out of 10, if not 10 out of 10 of these cases, the targets are, number one, U.S. military facilities, either recruiting centers, bases here and overseas, and number two, Jewish targets, synagogues, Jewish community centers here in America. With the military recruiting centers, with the U.S. military bases, the reasoning there is simple.
Why is that?
They see the U.S. military as the symbol of U.S. imperialism, U.S. aggression, the U.S. crusaders pillaging Muslim lands. So there's a lot of symbolism with the U.S. military among the jihadists. So that's pretty simple. And again, I say jihadist. This is a jihad plot. We have to get things very straight with this administration and with the current counterterrorism strategy. This case, the case 2 weeks ago out in Portland, Oregon, with the Somali, both of these guys, I think the most interesting aspects of the wiretaps, Michael, at least what has been released, both of these young guys spoke extensively about jihad and about Islamic teachings. This is not just terrorism. That's very vague. This is Islamist-inspired terrorism. These guys are quoting the Quran, quoting the Hadiths, they're talking about the jihad verses in the Quran. There is an ideological motivation behind these plots, and it's been glossed over by Democrats and most Republicans, quite frankly. It's just a war on terror. Well, there's an ideology behind that terror, and until we're honest about the ideology that we are up against, we're going to keep having these plots, and some of them, God forbid, may very well be successful. We have to be honest about the ideology. I'll leave you with one more quote from the guy Muhammad Hussein, who was arrested yesterday outside of Baltimore. He said, Michael, in an exchange, I believe with his wife or his mother, quote, "All I think about is jihad." Well, I wish our government would think a little bit more about jihad in terms of how to defeat it, because jihadist ideology is what motivates what we're up against.
This is unbelievable to me.
We talk about the government misunderstanding of the threat, misunderstanding, complete lack of understanding of our Islamist enemies. I have a great example for you, Michael, and this is going to make your head spin. Just happened last week. The good old U.S. State Department involved, not surprisingly. Our top diplomat, America's top diplomat in Great Britain, a guy named Louis B. Sussman. Now, he is our ambassador to Great Britain. That's a pretty prestigious position. By the way, the guy was a big Obama donor and backer. So Sussman, November 29th, just a week ago, visited the East London Mosque. Now, the East London Mosque is one of the largest, I believe, not only in Great Britain, but in Europe, some 5,000 worshippers. Also, Michael, the East London Mosque may be the most radical mosque in all of Western Europe, and that's saying something.
Wait a minute. How could this be going on?
The East London Mosque has played host to a litany, a long procession of pro-jihad, anti-American speakers, guys who are banned from entering the United States, regularly appear at this mosque. Now, Sussman was there last week, our ambassador to Great Britain. He was there schmoozing with the leadership of the East London Mosque, an anti-Semitic, anti-American leadership. Sussman is there schmoozing with them, talks about how much he, quote, admires the mosque, how honorable the mosque is, and Michael, get this, actually invites the young Muslims at the East London Mosque to come to America as part of a cultural exchange program. Now, Michael, if that wasn't bad enough, just 1 year before Sussman visited the East London Mosque, spent time schmoozing with the leaders there, Anwar al-Awlaki also visited the East London Mosque.
Unbelievable.
Anwar Awlaki, as you know, you and I have spoken about him many times, Michael, and his influence. He is behind bin Laden and Zawahiri, the most wanted Islamic terrorist in the world, and right now he is the most influential Islamic terrorist in the world. Well, in January 2009, he delivered a video address to the East London Mosque and participated in a live Q&A session with mosque goers. 2003, he also appeared at the East London Mosque, and while he was there, he encouraged his audience to not participate, to not cooperate with British counterterrorism authorities. So we have our leading diplomat in Great Britain following, arguably, the leading Islamic terrorist in the world. This is the situation we have right now in our diplomatic overtures, our diplomatic efforts to the Muslim world. Naturally, I was outraged by this story, Michael, so I contacted the U.S. State Department, and the State Department directed me to the U.S. Embassy in London, where Sussman is based.
And what was the British Embassy's response?
Michael, this is what they said. Yes, they acknowledged Sussman did indeed visit the East London Mosque. The pictures are up online of him with doing the grip and grins with the leaders of the East London Mosque. But the U.S. Embassy in London said he visited the mosque, he met with the leadership, and this is part, and this is the key point here, Michael, it's all part of the Obama administration's outreach to Muslims. As part of that outreach, Ambassador Sussman has visited many mosques throughout Great Britain, including the East London Mosque. It basically will continue to do so. This is a stated goal of the Obama administration to outreach to Muslims. And the East London Mosque has a diverse range of views among its members and leadership. This is according to the U.S. Embassy in London via the State Department. Now, I didn't see much diversity in views when I was there, Michael, back earlier this year, actually, when I was in London, spent some time at that mosque, did a little look-see. I didn't see much diversity in views there.
Oh, I can't believe that.
I saw jihadist ideology. I saw radicalism. That's all I saw. And historically, the East London Mosque is a known hotbed for jihad. I mean, Channel 4 in Great Britain did a whole documentary earlier this year in March about the radical links of the East London Mosque. Yet our top diplomat in Great Britain is going there and meeting with the members, meeting with the leadership, and he thinks it's a great place. This is what the Obama administration is doing. This outreach to the Muslim world is not targeting Muslims who oppose jihad. This is not targeting secular Muslims who oppose jihad, who don't support Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah. It's not targeting them. They're being bypassed, and quite frankly, they're tough to find as well. But I have met some, but they're being bypassed, and they're being bypassed in favor of the bad guys. The Obama administration is actively conducting outreach to the Muslim Brotherhood and Muslim Brotherhood-linked groups here in America and overseas.
Well, tell us more about the so-called Brotherhood.
The Muslim Brotherhood, Michael, as you know, is the granddaddy of them all when it comes to Islamic terrorist groups. They were the precursor, the inspiration for Al-Qaeda, for Hamas. Hamas, in fact, is the Gaza Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. So that gives you an idea where this group, the Muslim Brotherhood, is coming from. They have a litany of front groups here in the U.S., CARE, ISNA, MAS, the whole alphabet soup, these Islamic groups, all connected to the Brotherhood in one way or the other. The Obama administration, it's become obvious to me, Michael, covering this issue over the past 2 years, covering the administration over the past 2 years with this issue, they have made a conscious decision to reach out to the Muslim Brotherhood, to legitimize the Muslim Brotherhood. They are treating the Muslim Brotherhood as a group that they can deal with. This administration thinks they can work with the Muslim Brotherhood. It's pretty clear.
Sure.
Basically, Michael, their view is, if you're not blowing anyone up, you must be moderate. Right now, the Muslim Brotherhood, indeed, is not blowing anybody up. But once they gain power, once they gain influence, the violent aspect is the final stage of their jihad. The Muslim Brotherhood right now, it's a very stealthy, subversive type strategy. Ingratiate yourselves into the halls of power here, the halls of influence in the U.S. Once you gain enough power, once you wield enough influence, then we can move to the final stage, which is violent armed jihad and the institution of Islamic Sharia law in the West. That is the end game for the Muslim Brotherhood. Their own leaders, their own documents say as much. The Obama administration has to know this. Yet last week, we had Egyptian elections. Now, granted, Egypt isn't exactly a bastion of democracy. Far from it. Mubarak is a dictator, the Egyptian president.
Right.
But the alternative to Mubarak in Egypt right now, quite frankly, is the Muslim Brotherhood. That is their seat of power. So it was interesting to me, Michael, last week when we had these Egyptian elections, which I'm sure were rigged in Mubarak's favor and Mubarak's party's favor. Come on. But the Muslim Brotherhood would have stood to gain the most from a free and fair election there in Egypt. And I thought it was pretty telling that the Obama administration criticized the elections and criticized how opposition parties didn't get a fair say in those elections. The main opposition party in Egypt, the most influential opposition party there, is the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think it all speaks for them. It speaks for itself, Michael, how the Obama administration reacted there and how they've acted in the past 2 years in general with this quote-unquote Muslim outreach.
Thanks for the report, Eric.
Michael, thanks again. You can catch my show, Stackelbeck on Terror, at cbnnews.com. Thanks again.
Well, I'm going to keep saying this until you finally get it. You must read Trickle Up Poverty in order to understand what Obama is doing to our military and our national security. Get informed. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I wonder who wrote the book of love. Chapter 1 says the lover, you love with all your heart.
When this song came out, I think I was in high school with a crew cut. I don't know what. Play it louder. I want to remember. I want a reminiscence.
The meaning of romance.
59 Chevy, maybe. Yeah, like around there. One of the guys I knew, I told you, became a famous rock and roll singer for 2 years. We were schlepping to high school, college. He was in Japan. He was 16 years old. Huge rock and roll hit. We were so jealous. Came back, had a Jaguar, like a 21-year-old girlfriend. Eventually, though, you know, he flashed out and he went to work for the post office in Woodstock, New York. There's nothing wrong with being a postman. No, I'm serious. You know, if you get it young, you usually don't have it your whole life. It's guys like me who struggled for 40 years who finally, you know, can enjoy the fruits of their success. You know, did you ever think about that? Would you rather have it young? What if God gave you a choice? You can't have it your whole life, okay? You're either going to struggle your whole life and have it when you're older, okay? Or you're going to have a tremendous burst of success when you're young, and then in middle age, you're basically have nothing. I mean, which one would you take? You know that you would go for the first one if you were young, because you don't think tomorrow's ever coming, right? Now, what does it have to do with politics? I think Obama's very much like that adolescent. He doesn't understand that he has squandered his youth with this socialism. He cannot push anything forward ever again. He has been found out, discovered. The mask has been taken off. His extraordinary expenditures are being exemplified with this grotesque trip to India. If the man had truly been humbled by this election, as he claims he has been, chastened in some way, he hasn't. What he would do is say, you know, in light of the fact that I realize most Americans don't like this government spending, I'm canceling this trip to India because it was going to cost $200 million a day, and I really don't think we need a junket to India, and I'm not taking 3,000 people in warships. I'm canceling it. His popularity would soar, but he won't do that because he still has hubris. He still has hubris. The man still thinks he's, above it all. And that's it. Maybe that's good for all of us. So as I say, this friend of mine, I mean, that song reminded me of that. That's how I got back to politics. When you are as political as I am, everything is political. I don't care if it's a bad Indian meal or a good Italian meal.
I've got to know the answer. Was it someone from above?
I wonder who
wrote the book of love.
I got to tell you, this is a side note. I know you listen because this is one of the last places you can get real, honest, independent, conservative opinions and unfiltered news. And I want you to get the full impact of the Savage Nation. Go to TRN1.com, become a premium member, and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcast at TRN1.com. Click on my picture at TRN1.com today. There was a nut in Hawaii many years ago during the hippie era. He got stoned on marijuana. Speaking of marijuana, the things people do on the dope is impossible to believe. Some of them run for office. Some of them think they're talk show hosts. He was sure he could communicate with animals. He went into an animal cage at the Honolulu Zoo and was almost mauled to death because he was sure that they were communicating with him. You know, I mean, people get crazy on the marijuana, you know. So the pot's been decriminalized in the state of California by the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I don't know if that's such a good thing, because now you're going to get them driving around stone, and they're going to do so with impunity. I mean, many of them are driving stone right now, and I still believe it should be a felony to drive stoned or to drive drunk, period. Marijuana is called dope for a reason, my friends. It's because it makes you dopier. But anyway, we don't need to go into this again. Many of you are very defensive about marijuana, and you keep wanting to hear it's good. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.